Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me today are Jeff Ranke and Ben Munson. We are the editors of Manufacturing.net and Industrial Equipment News. We all have many years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we cover the five most popular stories on our website and discuss the implications that those have on the industry as we go forth. Please make sure you like, subscribe, and share the podcast. You can also help us out by leaving us a positive review on whatever platform you use. Finally, to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, Anna, or Ben at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. We are live every Thursday sometime. So one,
it will happen.
Yeah, at a time.
We are inevitable.
We do get it done. If you want to see us live, you can participate in the chat. If you subscribe to our YouTube channel, you'll get a notification when we go live. This week's episode is brought to you by SIGA Technologies. While it has always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now to watch Jeff's new interview with Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, to hear how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. No spoilers on that.
Watch it.
You have to watch it. Nothing from Jeff on that. No cheating.
No spoilers.
All right. Without further ado, I think let's kick off, guys.
Do we need to let them know why David's not here? Or is it we just can keep him in the dark?
David is safe.
Yes.
David is fine.
He's not sick.
He is out of the office for a pre-scheduled appointment with a client. So he'll be back next week as far as we know.
Yeah.
He's doing field work.
Yeah. He's doing field work, yes. But Ben graciously offered to stand in, and so we're happy to have Ben here. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks.
Good.
How are you?
Great. Thanks. Jeff?
I'm just okay, but I'm glad you guys are great. That'll make me feel better.
Well, I can feel the okay energy coming off you right now.
I do exude that.
Yeah. All right, let's start out with the OKS podcast in history. The number five most popular story on our websites this week was a story titled "Lack of Maintenance Sunk $6 Million Barge." A crane barge called the Ambition was being towed in the Gulf of Mexico when it sank on June 15th, 2022 and released nearly 2,000 gallons of oil. A recent NTSB investigation blamed the accident on failure to properly inspect and maintain the barge. Before towing the Ambition, a deckhand from the towing vessel checked out the vessel and found the ship had several hatch cover gaskets that were not in place, some hatch cover lids that were not physically locked, and some visible hull damage. After the accident, investigators found a 25-foot long separation along the weld seam between the bilge knuckle and the bottom plates that was addressed with a temporary fix. The report noted that an effective maintenance and hull inspection program should proactively address potential steel wastage, identify hull and watertight integrity deficiencies, and ensure corrosion issues are repaired in a timely manner by permanent means. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, equipment breaking down is one of the more common causes of oil spills. This particular incident resulted in a $6.3 million loss, though no one was thankfully hurt in the incident. Jeff, I know that you dug into this NTSB report a little bit, so I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you found.
So many things, Anna. And I feel like we can be a little bit lighthearted about this one because no one was hurt.
That's okay? True. Yeah.
So, but just from the very start of this whole thing and the report, to borrow, you know, David's kind of his process or whatever, and looking through these NTSB reports and how much he likes them, this is a relatively short one. And it is actually a very interesting read because it's very detailed and it goes through, I mean, right from the get-go. Again, the Ambition itself, basically, when you look at the core problem here, what caused it to sink, this would be like taking your car, lifting up the frame, putting in new axles and wheels on it that didn't come with the car, okay?
Yeah.
So they're already different, but they're just as old. And then never checking the tires. That's basically what these guys did and ran for about 25 years with just thinking, you know what? Well, we'll take a look at it. Oh, this one's got a flat. you know what we're going to do? We're going to put the spare on there, mm-hmm. and that'll be good forever. Even if you got the little donut thing on there, you know, that's basically how this thing was running. It was ridiculous. So from the fact that it had this welded patch job on there that was never set up to be a permanent fix, but they treated it like it was, to the fact that they were taking this barge out 6 to 12 times a year, but never checked with the Coast Guard because they didn't know they had to.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, we didn't know that was a thing. And the Coast Guard's like, yeah, we didn't know you were actually taking it out into the water. So right from the get-go, this thing was just – It's unbelievable. And I think the biggest thing that it really set up for me is I remember going fishing with my buddy in college and his dad left us a note and a bunch of stuff was like what to do when you get there. And the very first thing was put the plug in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you put the plug in so we don't get a bunch of water in there. Common sense, right? I mean, you should know how to do that. But still that old school thought of all of the little things, you know,
yeah.
the mm-hmm. blocking and tackling, as I like to say, and that seems to come to the forefront in all of these safety related stories we do. If we focus on the little things, which in this case is, you know, covering up the holes in a boat that's going in the water, that seems really important. So whether it's this, this leaking weld it sounds like a minor thing. It was 25 feet long.
It was so crazy.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, the pictures of it in the report, it's like you can't even believe it.
25 feet long, and it was rusting out other places that were not repaired. They had open hatches on this barge. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about sailing, but you shouldn't have doors open when you don't want water to get in there. And then the fix, they basically were taking it down the waterway, and they stopped for gas to fill it up, which probably made things worse as well from an environmental perspective as well as from a weight perspective. And that's when the towboat, the Karen Kobe, was basically like, hey, you guys need to check everything out over on your boat, the Ambition. And they went around locking up because the person on the Karen Kobe was towing it out said, hey, got a bunch of hatches open. We can't do this. This isn't going to work. So the crew from the Ambition went on and said, yeah, we took care of it. No problem. Their solution was basically what Ben, throwing a piece of iron metal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the quote was, I threw a big plate on it.
Yeah.
A big metal plate on it.
Which, no seal, no nothing. I mean, it was just a comedy of errors that just continued on and on. It was incredible. And again, I think it just goes back to the fact that they had been doing this 6 to 12 times a year. They figured we'd done this before. It's not a big deal. And they weren't going through all of those elementary basic safety precautions that you need to go through just for that process. Forget about all the things that should have been happening beforehand from mm-hmm. a maintenance perspective. It was just a combination of not doing any of the little things that could have potentially, in my opinion, avoided this whole catastrophe from happening. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think so many catastrophes come from that that theory that it worked last time.
Right.
Right. Like, yeah. Which does not speak at all to the you know, foresight of being able to make that work in the future.
Yeah, the towing process sounded a little fun as well.
Oh, man.
I think they towed it. They hit something. They hit like a wooden marker pretty early on.
Yeah.
And the captain of the towing vessel was like, no, it seems okay.
It's fine.
I think we're fine. Yeah. Let's not take a look. Let's just keep going. And then they were towing at night, right?
Yeah.
And the captain's like, I'm pretty sure it's still there. And it was not entirely still there. And I think the other person noticed because of their speed was slowing mm-hmm. down. And it was probably because they're towing a sinking ship.
Carrying a couple extra tons of water gave it away. Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, it was not in great shape. I think we were all less than impressed with the quality of that ship, the condition of it.
Yeah, and yet it was worth over $6 million. So if you have a really good condition tow barge or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you're in good. Yeah,
you got a good crane barge.
Yeah.
It must be worth a ton of money.
Very good point, Ben. And to me, very alarming, I think, to see how much of it was like, well, this doesn't look great, but we're going to move forward anyway.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it just makes you wonder what kind of condition the rest of the boats are in. If this was not an immediate, we need to shut this thing down. We're not going to hook it up. We're not going to take it because it is in such terrible shape. Nobody did that. I mean, they all just and kind of blame game a little bit where somebody was like, well, I was looking at it, didn't look good. But then the captain, I thought, said that we were good to go. So I just walked away.
Yeah. I couldn't believe how everybody on the Karen Kobe went on and basically found all these things that were wrong with the boat. again, but they were like at the fueling station, the refueling station, when they found all this stuff, pointed it all out. The people at the Ambition just sort of half-assed it, jumped off and went away and let them tow it out there. I mean, like you said, the circle of blame is incredible here. It's kind of mind-blowing when you, how well for a government agency and how plainly this is all laid out in this report. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that name too, it feels like there's a metaphor there. Like if your ambition was to stay afloat.
Yeah.
You failed.
You failed.
At what age, Ben, did your ambition start to take on water?
Wow. There's a podcast.
Moving on. Our fourth most popular story this week is another catastrophe, so let's buckle up.
Good thing I'm just in an okay mood, because otherwise I'd really be feeling low now.
The title of this article is Root Cause Found in Plane That Suffered Wheel Collapse. So investigators have determined that a pin broke inside the left landing gear of an Alaska Airlines jet that came to rest on one of the engines after landing in California last month. Attempting a firm landing during Tropical Storm Hillary, which was later described as actually not very poor weather, but they were taking a precaution, I think, the pilot said that they felt a jolt feeling when the plane touched the runway. The landing force was later determined to have complied with regulations. After the plane landed, the captain told the co-pilot that it felt like the plane had a flat tire. But upon opening the window, the pilots observed that the plane was resting on the housing surrounding the left engine. The engines were shut down and passengers evacuated safely using the taxiway. No injuries were reported. The NTSB said that its examination found that a trunnion pin in the left landing gear had broken and the gear assembly punched through the top of the left wing. The board said that it will continue to investigate the accident. Jeff, what did you think about this story about the airplane?
A number of things. I think looking at some of the pictures, and I know Ben's going to talk about some of the video too. I mean, harrowing, kind of. If you're a passenger and you actually could see what was going on, you know, the pilot said it felt like a flat tire. If you've been going fast enough and you get a flat tire, that's scary enough. But when you're on a plane that large, I can only imagine what this must have felt like if you were on that side of the plane. I mean, that had to be terrifying. So there's that dynamic. There's also the fact that Boeing really doesn't need to continue getting these types of headlines, even though this looks like, I mean, when you're looking at a high alloy steel pin here, I mean, these things, they don't break. The amount of weight and the amount of pressure that was being placed on it was actually lower than what at the highest level of stress that it's supposed to be able to tolerate would be. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing out of ordinary from an operational perspective. It looks like this was a bit of a, you know, one in a million type of dynamic, but still so scary. And again, Boeing does not need any more quality control scrutiny. So there's that dynamic as well. I think, again, looking at the pictures, this feels like it could have been so much worse than what it was. Appreciate the hard work of those pilots and their training kind of coming into play. I can't imagine too, you know, the other thing is thankfully at the side that was sort of wavering or was resting on the engine housing was not the side that the passengers got out on, mm-hmm. which I think that would have been even more unnerving or caused even a greater maybe stir from the passengers, because maybe potentially a lot of them were like, well, that was kind of bumpy, not so bad, if you weren't looking out the window seeing it. So
yeah, seeing crazy. The gear assembly punch through the top of the left wing. Ben, tell us a little bit about the footage that you saw.
Yeah, it was somebody filming the landing, a 16-year-old. And I'm not sure why he was filming the landing, but it was dark, storming. I'm sure everybody was a little freaked out. And then it hits, and all of a sudden there's the sparks shooting out everywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because it's so dark, you can really see them. And then the expletives start to fly. and I was like, I would feel the same way. Like, I would really be.
Well, there was a ton of smoke, too. I mean, it was eerie the way that was coming off walking in that video. Man.
But the pin just popped. That basically what happened?
It snapped, mm-hmm. yeah, and everything mm-hmm. else just went shooting straight up. It's crazy to look at the damage. When you look at just the plane from the front, it's just kind of tilting, you know, it doesn't look too serious. Then you look where that actually broke off and where the landing gear shot up through the wing. That is...
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't get a number on the cost of the damage, but it was described as tremendous. I don't know exactly what it would take to fix a punctured wing and all the other stuff that came along with it.
Yeah.
So the investigation will continue, as mentioned, where the NTSB is going to examine the broken trunnion at its laboratories. They also said they're going to listen to the cockpit recordings, which seems to be a bit overkill at this point, because I think the first instinct, of course, was to probably blame operational error, because that's what everyone thought at first, that they landed too hard. But those pilots were, I think, kind of cleared in that. So it just, we'll see what happens as they continue to investigate. But it's probably easier in my thought that, like, if you can blame it on one person's actions versus a component that now they have to review the efficacy of and decide if they need to swap it out or it needs to be bolstered in some way. I don't know. That's a lot bigger problem to solve.
Yeah, I have a feeling if Boeing needs to throw somebody under the bus, I believe Magellan Aerospace was actually the manufacturer of the pins that they use for these planes. So I think they would be pretty quick to deflect there if they can or if they need to. So that could be the next sort of step in the story if that comes into greater scrutiny. I don't know. Game.
But yeah, who makes the engine? Because that did a great job.
Yeah, kept going, you're right.
I mean, it kept the plane up. Yeah,
yeah,
you can land on that thing.
Yeah. Not what it's designed for, but you can do it.
Yeah.
All right, so I actually just realized that our next story is also about a catastrophe.
Almost.
There's a little bit of a theme developing here. Catastrophe week.
Thanks, David.
This next story is about Tesla's Cybertruck and how it lost a wheel cover on a freeway. So as the long anticipated and much delayed Tesla Cybertruck approaches deliveries expected this quarter, reports have emerged of prototypes being spotted out in the wild. And while many showcase the model charging or speculate on changes to the interior or exterior, another video recently surfaced that could be cause for concern. So originally reported by Electrek, a dash cam video captured a sequence in which a wheel cover from a Cybertruck test vehicle detached, soared into the air, and landed on a busy San Francisco freeway. So aerodynamic wheel covers are thought to increase an EV's efficiency. This can lead to less requisite power, fewer batteries, making a vehicle lighter and possibly cheaper. So you can see the appeal. According to Tesla's website, customers can purchase wheel covers for $25 or $35 each. The Cybertruck reportedly features removable aerodynamic tire covers, and images have shown the vehicle both with and without these caps. So the cause of the incident remains uncertain, but Electrek suggested that a loose connection might have contributed to the detachment, potentially stemming from a design flaw in the attachment point or a complex attachment process. So that's a lot of speculation from Electrek, but you can kind of see why they went there. Right, Ben?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as far as I understand, these aerodynamic wheel covers, they're designed to reduce wind resistance, and they actually seem like they do increase range. Like, I think Car and Driver reviewed the Tesla Model 3 aero wheels a few years back, and they got an extra 10 miles of range, which is not nothing.
Yeah.
But they need to stay on in order to do that, right? And then if they come off while you're driving fast, that's another really scary thing. That's bad, right? So
I mean, not for the driver, but yeah, for everybody else.
Right, yeah. So if there's a design flaw, I don't know if you've ever been driving.
Not for the driver.
They could just keep going. But then
they had to swerve around it in the video.
I mean, the person driving the truck, they're fine. It's just everybody else. It's kind of fine.
But it's not like a hubcap flying off is like a unique Cybertruck problem.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's happening every day, right? But
right.
So you're not worried about it?
No, not particularly. This doesn't feel like a huge issue. Like, if there is a design flaw, it hasn't entered production yet, right? They're still testing.
As far as I know, yes. Although deliveries are supposed to take place very soon. So, but you know, I know Elon Musk doesn't like to push back a deadline. He might have to do that.
He also doesn't like to push forward maybe prematurely.
And you have never seen that from Tesla ever, right?
I think Ben is being way too calm and rational. We like to jump to a lot of conclusions on this podcast, Ben. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe speculate on on things.
It's catastrophe week. Yeah. I thought we already covered that. Yes. Okay.
Finding hubcaps was always kind of fun though. Like, like you find one and then you're kind of beholden to either prop it up against like the utility pole so the owner can find it when they're driving around later on, or you could take it home and hang it on your wall. This is what my big brother did. That was pretty cool. I was like, that's cool.
Jeff, so you're taking this a little bit more seriously than old hubcap over here.
While I'm pro hubcap collectors, I think this could potentially look. It could potentially be nothing. It could just be some bad clips. Okay, that like Ben said. I mean, this isn't an uncommon thing, but when we look at some of the issues that Tesla has had in developing this truck, the delays that they've had in getting it to market, and let's be honest, Elon Musk does not like being called out on quality issues. The website Motor1.com actually made an interesting observation. I'm going to quote right from their site. They said, we can't speculate that it might have something to do with the gap between the tire and the plastic cover that's there presumably to allow cold air to reach the brakes. Compared to other wheel covers offered by Tesla for its other models, the Cybertruck is the only one that has a closed-off design, while the others sit flush with the tire, but cutouts allow the air to go through. So there could be something going on here that's more than just simply a bad clip, but it could also lead to a bigger issue. If you've got these trucks that people are running harder, they're always going to be pushing for miles and range and everything else. If they're not allowing proper cooling procedures through these, mm-hmm. no matter how good they look, no matter how much they aid efficiency and range, this could actually be a huge quality control issue that is coming to light now, thankfully, during testing. So it could be nothing. It could be something very small. But in this instance, this is an area where I think Elon Musk, because he's so outspoken, kind of becomes the de facto voice of the entire Tesla organization. This does make you pause for a second. You know, when I first saw the headline, I'm like, I was kind of like where Ben was. You know, it's a hubcap. This isn't a huge deal. They do come off. But then when you look into it a little bit deeper, maybe there is more to it. And maybe they are pushing this because they have been so far behind on this. They're seeing more pressure. They're seeing what Ford is doing. They're seeing what Rivian is doing. I can't believe the number of Rivian trucks I actually see around Madison.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Maybe this is them pushing a little bit too fast and not just sort of, again, doing some of that blocking and tackling they need to do and hitting all the little things and making sure everything's right before they go to market.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's some of that there. I also think that, you guys have heard this, I'm sure, as writers. This is one thing that you're taught very early in the game, which is never get so attached to your own words that you can't see them objectively and delete the whole thing and start mm-hmm. over if you need to do it better. I think there's a little bit of that as well, where I think Elon Musk, especially with the Cybertruck design, there's so many features and design components to this that I feel like don't need to be there.
And, it's possible.
And maybe he's doing it because he likes how they look and he's determined to make it that way. But, you know, you've read reports about how, certain design components of just the exterior make it hard to see, or the wipers aren't able to reach across the entire giant front window. Things like that, where you think if you're really focused on functionality and not just how beautiful is this design in my own mind?
Which is also relative with the Cybertruck.
Right. Then you might need to revisit some of these selections and choices and maybe do them a little differently. And so I feel like I'm not that surprised that we're seeing a lot of clunkiness as the prototypes come out and you hear these reports of problems. I hope that they will take a hard look at this and maybe make some changes where they need to be made. But you never know with Tesla.
Ben, what do you think of the look of the Cybertruck?
It's kind of grown on me. I know a lot of people described it when it was first announced as like, it looks like it hasn't finished rendering yet, or like it looks like Nintendo 64 truck. But yeah, it's dumb, but kind of in a cool way, you know?
See, it looks like something out of like Minecraft. My daughters used to play that all the time. This looks like that. This looks like the vehicle they would have in Minecraft.
I'm just like, it's funny to think that these people will buy these and then have to do mundane like pickup truck stuff with it too. Like help your friend move a couch with the Cybertruck.
You're gonna look so cool doing it. We have a comment from Seth, who's watching us live. Thanks, Seth. That says, I come here for the speculation. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
We will continue to do that. And we've got more stories
to come.
Thank
you for not calling it wild speculation. Yeah, like just, it's controlled.
Just regular. Yeah, just, run-of-the-mill speculation. Everybody does it. All right. So our next most popular story of the week is about a man-made hamster wheel, which is probably what everyone was guessing. the title is Man-Made Hamster Wheel Tries to Cross the Atlantic Ocean. So here's what happened. An extreme runner named Reza Baluchi was trying to traverse the Atlantic Ocean in a structure that resembles an adult-sized hamster wheel.
Adult size.
Hard to even say that.
Like an adult hamster?
An adult-sized hamster. Yeah. An adult human-size hamster wheel. When the U.S. Coast Guard spotted him, and that's where the trouble began. According to a criminal complaint, the Coast Guard was preparing for Hurricane Franklin when they found Baluchi while transiting the Atlantic Ocean 70 nautical miles off the coast of Georgia. After deeming the vessel, which was afloat as a result of wiring and buoys, as being unsafe, they asked him to disembark, at which point Baluchi threatened to harm himself and others. Negotiations took 3 days before he was brought to shore. Baluchi is charged with obstruction of a boarding and a violation of a captain of the port order. But it's not even his first attempt. Over several past tries, he attempted the journey, even despite a captain of the port order in 2015 declaring the vessel manifestly unsafe. But the order did give Baluchi a path, and reports say that the Coast Guard wanted to be kept in the loop and require him to undergo inspections and bring a support vessel, a request that Baluchi did not comply with. Baluchi is behind the Run With Reza website, which is portrayed as a charitable effort where Baluchi attempts to traverse great distances in unorthodox ways, like the hamster wheel, and also running cross-country barefoot, in order to travel the world to bring awareness to causes related to, quote, Iran, women, life, and freedom. Those are all things, Ben, that deserve our attention. What happened here?
I got to be honest, I was kind of rooting for him after reading all of this, but it doesn't sound like a great try at it. And this is his fourth try, right?
Yeah. Fourth try,
Yeah, and I... What struck me was how long the standoff lasted.
Yeah.
A 3-day standoff. What does that look like in the water? Are they just sort of floating next to each other?
Coast Guard a lot of credit for their patience here. Mm-hmm. They were also preparing for a hurricane at the time. So, mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah. And he threatened to get violent with himself, with them. I think he ultimately admitted to them, though, that he didn't actually have a bomb. He didn't build an exploding hamster wheel, mm-hmm. which is a regular one. But, you know, he was trying to get to London, right? Because he was going to kind of pick up his jog
yep.
yeah. when he got there, right? And what, he was 70 miles off the coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's generous to say he could cover that amount of ground in one day. But then that's like a 59-day journey to London in the wheel.
I think that's generous. Very yeah. generous.
yeah. But so it's a long time in the wheel. And
yeah.
I don't think he had enough food in there. They tried to bring him food at some point, right?
He did have fishing rods. He was going to catch fish to sustain him on the way.
Just eat them right out of the water.
Apparently.
Or did he have like a...
I didn't see a camp stove.
A little stovetop.
Yeah, I didn't see that in there.
One wrongly positioned fish hook and this whole thing goes down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if he was going to make it or not, Ben. It seems like it was a pretty ambitious effort there.
Yeah, if you follow the path that he was on, it looked like he was kind of heading north, which is not going to get you to London, I don't think, right? Yeah, he was a little bit off course. And with a support vehicle, maybe this would have been possible. You know, hop out in the morning, do your thing, and then you're mm-hmm. back on the boat at night, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
it seems like it would be the smart thing to do, but that maybe didn't cross his mind. I don't know. Yeah.
It seems like there's a way to do it, but I don't want to.
Yeah. I know we've all thought about the hamster wheel ocean thing many times, but
oh, yeah. If I had a dollar.
Yeah, I know, right? Do you think that you could have made it work, Jeff?
I feel like somebody needs to go up to, how would you pronounce his first name? Is it Reza?
I think it's Reza.
Reza. And just kind of like put your arm around his shoulder and be like, hey, buddy, like what you're trying to do here is great. Okay. Because the things he's trying to raise awareness of and where he comes from, his background. The other thing is he's kind of an amazing endurance athlete. When you look at the things that he was doing, this was an individual who was going on 620 mile bike rides and running around the perimeter of the U.S. I mean, it's amazing what he is physically capable of doing. And the Coast Guard, again, I think was being very reasonable and being, hey, get another vehicle out here in case something goes sideways. You don't really think that this vessel, this hamster wheel, which just to sort of give everybody a visual, it's exactly what you would expect, essentially. It's a transparent sort of plastic pod. It's attached to a big metal frame, and it's got spokes that then are attached to, I think there's sort of those 36 inflatable balls, basically on the, I don't know what you would call it, the runner, the wheel part of it.
Yeah, so, it's like a paddle wheel kind of.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, from an engineering perspective, it's kind of impressive. He invested like $5,000 into it in order to make it. So give him, you know, there's some ingenuity there. Again, as my drill sergeant said to me numerous times in basic training, excellent initiative, poor execution. He needs some guidance here because I think what things he wants to accomplish are very positive. But again, there's very little safety and planning involved here. And that's what he needs for something like, if you're going to be this crazy and great and generate awareness for all these causes, which are good, you need some better support mechanisms in place. You can't just do it, obviously.
Yeah, so. It's a pretty cool prototype that he put together there. And it definitely looks like something that I would rent. Like when you go to the
100%.
When you go to the lake and they have like the paddle boats that look like ducks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could have the hamster wheel right next to it.
Yeah.
Take it out on a lake. That's what this is appropriate for. Like the ocean is a completely different ballgame. Do you know how easily this thing could get punctured or clipped by a bigger vessel? Or, I mean, there's just so many dangers out there. It's crazy to think that that was his plan, was to just keep going for.
And he was going to pull a live fish into it also?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't want to be wrestling a fish in one of those.
No.
Well, he's going up top. He's got it planned out. It's very clear.
And it is too bad because you mentioned some of the things that he's trying to promote and bring awareness to. Like, they're all very positive things. And now all these people in the world are going to know him for his like really outsized, aggressive and violent reaction to being caught. When this was completely unnecessary. It's very impressive, all the running stuff that he's already been doing. Yeah. So you just kind of wonder, like, what is your mission exactly? And now the awareness of this stuff is sort of on the back burner. Now everyone just knows you as, like, the guy who threatened the Coast Guard with a knife.
Coast Guard did a great job on this one. I know it was the fourth time they've
encountered this. Practice, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But they showed a lot of patience, just kind of hanging out there with him for 3 days.
For sure. And let's not be remiss and skip over the fact that they were preparing for a hurricane.
Yeah.
So
crazy.
Like, just like kind of underscores how dangerous this was, just the circumstances there, but also that they probably had a lot of other things that they could have been doing at that time.
Yeah. I think at one point during the standoff, they brought him food, water, and a weather report, presumably that they had like printed off.
Yeah, that, I mean,
like there's a hurricane coming.
Yeah, and clearly he didn't have access to that information on his own, so that's like another terrifying component. But anyway, moving on to our most popular story this week. This is a doozy. I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say about this one. The story is Lucid's CEO's salary, a staggering $379 million. So Peter Rawlinson, the CEO of EV startup Lucid Motors, made an unbelievable amount of money last year. That's an understatement. Rawlinson's base salary is $575,000, but he also took home $5.5 million in stock options and some $373 million in stock awards for a total of about $379 million. Comparing this to Lucid's automotive peers, and I think it's being generous to even call them peers when you bring in names like GM, right? So the CEO, Mary Barra, made $34 million in 2022. Ford's Jim Farley brought in $18.3 million. And Rivian's RJ Scaringe took home $1 million. Elon Musk, who once employed Rawlinson as his chief engineer for the Tesla Model S, said of the report, quote, "Beware any company where leadership compensation is not linked to performance." But Rawlinson's salary was, sort of. The company hit market cap targets last year, and this year it outsold its goals. But it bears consideration that the goal was 7,000 vehicles on the year, not to mention Lucid's stock tumbled 82%.
Ouch.
The company's total revenue was $608 million. As David says at the conclusion of this video report, the company's goals double in 2023. We'll see if Rawlinson's pay does the same. What do you guys think?
I'll let Ben go first on this one.
Yeah, it's a gross amount of money, when especially considering it's like over half of their revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, reading some of the SEC filings from Lucid, they were not subtle about talking about how important Rawlinson is to the company. They said, "We are highly dependent on the services of Peter Rawlinson, our chief executive officer and chief technology officer. Mr. Rawlinson is a significant influence on and driver of our technology development and business plan. If Mr. Rawlinson were to discontinue his service with us due to death, disability, or any other reason, we would be significantly disadvantaged." So they're basically saying, we can't do this without him.
So is all that money basically, does he travel in a bubble? Like, they're worried about him dying or getting sick? I mean,
that is a huge liability to be so dependent on one person. Yeah.
Yikes. But it still seems excessive in terms of a compensation package, especially when the company is still trying to get up to speed.
Yeah. Is it though? I wish David was here for the story.
Oh, here we go, Jeff.
So I just wish David was here so much for this one.
Here we go. David, if you're watching, solidarity.
I think, first of all, it's when you look at stock awards, this can mean a lot. Now, $370 million of anything is a ton, okay? But it doesn't necessarily mean cash directly in his bank account. It can be a lot of, it can mean a lot of different things. He may have to invest a certain amount back into the company. There could be different, what's the term I'm looking for here? Times before he can become fully vested. I can't remember the term now. Anyway, a lot of different things could go into that, different restrictions, different percentages, timelines, vestitures. That's the word I was looking for. So it's not going right there, but it's still obviously a hugely generous bump, incentive, whatever you want to say. I think what's also interesting is when you look at the way those incentives are paid out, the company is looking to generate more than 10,000 vehicles this year. They are on a pace to have a 30% increase in terms of their revenues. And the other thing I think was interesting is they're up to having about $6.25 billion in, total liquidity. Thank you. I'm so good with all these financial terms. $6.25 billion in total liquidity, which means basically all of their assets, everything they could get from a loan, they have this much available to them, which so they're good till, they said in the report, at least 2025. If they don't sell another vehicle, they would be able to maintain operations. So if this individual has played this big of a part in terms of the engineering, production, supply chain, everything else that goes into bringing the product to market, and they are hitting their goals for the first 2-3 years here, this is how you want to compensate them. I don't think it's gross. I don't think it's ridiculous. I don't think it's excessive. I think it's what he earned, because this is what they want to give him. And I will double down every time we do a story on this in saying, you are worth what the market says you're worth. And if Lucid said he's worth $380 million, that's what he's worth.
That's not the market talking though, Jeff. I feel like this company is like being held hostage by this person, not because he's trying to do it, but they're so leveraged on the fact that like he can get them to where they need to be. I think that's a problem for the company. I think that they need to really look at what this means. If they think $300 million in stock options is what they need to pay to keep this one, I don't know, linchpin in their system. I mean, there's a lot wrong with that, in my opinion, but I won't get into the ethical issue I have, I guess, with one person in a company making that much money. But I will say that the average Lucid Motors salary ranges from approximately $69,000 per year for customer care specialist to $224,000 per year for electrical designer. The average hourly pay ranges from $19.44 per hour for shipping and receiving clerk to $38.31 per hour for operations associate. This is California, by the way.
I was going to say, those are low for California. That's.
And I'm not saying that they're, I mean, they're, you know, that starting $19, that's pretty low, but for anywhere. But I'm not trying to make the point that these salaries are too low. I'm saying that, you know, let's view them as standard potentially here. And if they were higher, wouldn't we be concerned about the burn rate on this company? I guess to me, like in the grand scheme of things, with this company having so much to prove still, I understand that they have a lot of liquidity and that's fine, but they're also facing a lot of headwinds, in my opinion. And all EV makers are facing the same challenge now, which is now that we have these products that are come to market, we've proven that they're viable, we've proven that they're appealing. Now we have to get the price down. And Lucid's cheapest vehicle is $82,000 starting. So they have a niche market in an industry where there is a ton of competition, and that competition is just growing at a super rapid pace. And I think that they need to be able to look at the future and think, we need to absorb some of this as we go, because selling $250,000 EVs, like, that's not a massive market.
No, I would agree with you on the front, and Ben alluded to it as well. If he is that indispensable, that is an issue. Okay, I would agree 100% there. And that would be a problem, especially like you said. I think Lucid, though, they want to sell these high-end vehicles. That is how they market themselves. So the quantity of sales is not going to be as important as like when Tesla rolled out the M3 or anything like that. However, there's going to come a time where obviously this is going to need to be scaled back. I don't know. I think you can, again, this is also relative in terms of what the actual value or dollar price you put on something is, but if they feel like he is this just crucial to getting this company up and running, I understand where they are coming from. However, when you do look at some of those hourly wages, that is concerning, and that doesn't seem to be something that's going to be able to carry forward. Mm-hmm. At some point, you're going to need to start paying those people a higher wage, especially if you're going to have operations in California. So that will be an interesting dynamic to sort of see how that plays out.
And oddly, it's like him accepting this compensation package doesn't seem to be a big vote of confidence in Lucid. Like, he's looking to cash in now, you know, before they've even really carved out any part of the market.
A safety net, really. I mean, to have all that stock.
Again, we don't know how much of that he does. He may have to vest some of that back into the company. There may be some timelines associated with it. Granted, he will get it eventually. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to debate that, but yeah, we don't know all the details, I guess.
True, but still too much. Matt, who's listening to us live, says that nobody is worth that much. And as Anna says, if he's that important, they are in trouble when he does retire or leave. I agree with what I said. Mark ECD, also watching us live, thanks for joining, says, I know a guy that makes hamster wheels that they could hire cheap.
Well played, Mark.
All right. We'll have to have a follow-up segment on this next week so David can yell at you.
I look forward to it. He gets so angry. It makes my day.
He would be sad about missing this conversation. All right. So before we move on to, in case you missed it, we're going to talk quickly again about SIGA Technologies, our sponsor this week. So again, while it's always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now to watch Jeff's new interview with Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, to hear how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. All right. In case you missed it, I want to start with Ben today because Ben is a special guest on today's panel. So what did you select for your In Case You Missed It this week?
That's nice. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I picked Johnson & Johnson is ditching its script logo after more than 130 years. Johnson & Johnson is getting rid of its highly recognizable script logo, which has been in use since 1887, and it's based on the signature of founder James Wood Johnson. The reasoning is sound. You know, J&J just recently spun off its consumer products division, which makes products like Band-Aid and Tylenol. And that company is now called Kenvu. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Kenvu. And eventually that's going to be the name that shows up on the packaging. instead of J&J.
Oh, but, okay.
But the new logo that they chose is basically the same, just with like zero personality. So I'm wondering, why not just embrace tradition and keep it the same? If you used it for 130 years, more than 130 years, like why change it now?
Well, wasn't one of the reasons that they're changing it is because kids aren't learning cursive anymore and it's in cursive?
They spoke to an expert in the Associated Press story. Yeah. And they said kids aren't learning cursive anymore. So maybe that's part of it. But this is the logo for Johnson & Johnson, which is like a medical device company now.
Yeah.
Almost exclusively. So are they worried that the kids are going to see this logo a lot? Like when they're looking for like an MRI machine.
And then they're like, what does this say? Not doing it.
I don't know who this is from. I can't do this.
Yeah. Well, I can't read that.
And also like it kind of, in my opinion, some of those logos that have been around for so long, you see them. It's not like you read them. You just know, you just accept them, right?
You know what it is.
You know what it is. You're not like reading the Johnson and the Johnson.
I guess I would say if I did not understand cursive, I would look at the J there and be a little confused maybe.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter's in third grade and she does not read cursive. They never learned it and they won't. So anytime cursive comes up, she does ask me to read it sometimes. She doesn't always get the squigglies. I don't know. Jeff, what do you think about the logo redesign?
I'm always really leery of those just for the reasons you mentioned, because it personifies your brand so much. There's so much equity, especially in that Johnson & Johnson script, in my opinion. Maybe I've just, you know, in 20 years that would go away because they have the new one. But for me, it just seems so iconic and so well received and understood. I'd be really careful in navigating away from that. But I can get where they're coming from in terms of what that logo is actually going to be on now as opposed to in the past. If it's not going to be on baby powder and things like that, maybe it's not as important. And maybe you want clarity there exactly who it is. So I can see a little bit of both sides. If it's my call personally, I want to. I like staying with things that are well recognized and well known. So I think you got to be careful there.
Fair enough. All right, Jeff, what is your In Case You Missed It this week?
You'll like this one, Anna.
Yes.
It's not about catastrophes yet.
Finally.
So my story was entitled, Toyota Builds a System That Produces Electricity, Hydrogen, and Water. And I like these types of stories because it takes a lot of this sort of emerging technology and gives a practical application to it. So Fuel Cell Energy and Toyota Motor North America have announced the completion of what they're calling the first of its kind tri-gen system at Toyota's Port of Long Beach operations. The system, which is going to be owned and operated by Fuel Cell Energy, produces renewable electricity, renewable hydrogen, and water from directed biogas. So basically what they have on site there, and this is going to be right at Toyota's Port of Long Beach Logistics Service, where basically they're taking all the cars that are coming in, getting them cleaned, ready for delivery, all that type of stuff right from the container ships. And they're using this new platform that uses basically biogas generated from local food waste, agricultural businesses, things like that, to then run it through these very complex machines to produce enough electricity, renewable electricity, which will be offtaken to Long Beach to support operations at the port, processes approximately 200,000 new Toyotas and Lexuses each year. So that operation will be supported by the electricity generated from this tri-gen system. It's also going to produce up to 1,200 kilograms a day of hydrogen, which can provide the Long Beach fueling needs for its incoming light-duty fuel cell vehicles. And it's also going to produce up to 1,400 gallons of water per day that they can use for stuff like washing vehicles and things of that nature. So it's just really cool to see this new type of technology that's looking at renewable energy sources for a very practical application. I think it's a great, it's probably like a very interesting miniature pilot program, if you will, because it's a very contained environment. Toyota's going to be able to see how all of these things flow together, probably increase efficiencies in certain places, especially when you look at hydrogen for fuels. You know, it's something we continue to see more and more about in terms of how, if we can make it so it's more scalable, less expensive, less environmentally difficult to create and generate. And here again, they're using directed renewable biogases. I think this is just a really interesting project to keep an eye on and how it could possibly scale up. And when you look at a company again like Fuel Cell Energy, sort of at the ground floor of these types of developments, these are the types of companies that could make things happen down the road too. So I thought it was just a really interesting, it's actually going to be put into use. So it's not even really a pilot program. It's mm-hmm. it's just more of a miniaturization of something and see where it goes from here.
It's a relatively small operation too for yeah. everything that it's producing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like I said, cool one to keep the eye on, I think.
Yeah, a 20-year purchase agreement as well. So what do you think about this partnership, Ben?
I think it's cool. I mean, when you can, you know, keep your footprint small and then yeah. also, have a versatile operation like this, I think it's great. And I think I would be really interested to see how it could scale up and what the other applications might be for it, you know, particularly the water there. Mm-hmm. Could this be drinking water at some point?
I think it would need additional filtration. I think it's because it's more of a byproduct from the hydrogen creation. But, you know, again, that's one of those things down the road that we can look at. Because, right. again, if you're mm-hmm. looking at producing more and more hydrogen for vehicles, and this is a byproduct, there's a lot of benefits there too, especially when you look at the drought that's going on in the western part of the country. Who knows what different types of options you have available, where it can go, you know. The other one of my favorite sayings, Anna, this could be another one of those things that leads to the thing. So
could be like a closed loop water park.
Even better. Yeah. Who needs crops? We got a water park.
They already have those. They're called splash pads. They are disgusting. I thought this was cool too. I agree with you guys both. I also thought initially my reaction to this was, you know, obviously Toyota has been committed to this idea of bringing hydrogen to market. Yeah. And even when their competitors are going electric and people are kind of walking away from that basket, Toyota is still there and saying, no, we're going to pursue this. So that's impressive, I think, on its own.
Yeah.
Because there's not as much momentum behind this as there is with electrification. As you said, just kind of as a test bed to see what they can learn here, how it sort of improves public perception to just see it like safely put to use, that I think will maybe be a benefit to overall trying to get these scaled up in other ways.
Well, I mean, it's the least glamorous part of this, but I'm interested too, because with a lot of these renewable energy options that we have, it's collecting the rootstock of what you need mm-hmm. to produce, in this case, biogas. So just that process of getting that food and agricultural waste, again, not a real glamorous thing to think about, but that's such a big part of a lot of this. We look at those renewable aviation fuels. One of the biggest issues there is collecting the oil from the fast food companies or whatever else you're going to use. So I think that's another thing that'll get worked out in these types of situations. That'll be cool to see.
Yeah, definitely. All right. The last, in case you missed it, I selected this story because it got my attention because it's kind of fun. But it's about the National Toy Hall of Fame announcing their 12 finalists for the year. So 12 finalists are being considered for induction in this year's National Toy Hall of Fame. And Ken is one of them, riding the coattails of the recent feature film. my words, not the words of the article. But Ken is up against. All right. You guys ready?
Yep.
Okay. Baseball cards, Battleship, Bingo, Bop It, Cabbage Patch Kids, Choose Your Own Adventure books, Connect Four, The Little Tykes Cozy Coop, Nerf, Slime, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
There's some heavy hitters.
There are. I know. So the National Toy Hall of Fame, which is housed at the Strom Museum in Rochester, New York, is marking its 25th anniversary this year. Honorees will be inducted on November 9th following voting by a selection committee and the public. Each member of the 22-person expert committee will cast ballots for the top three, and then the three toys that receive the most public votes by September 20th will make up a single ballot. So, guys, there's not a lot of time left to vote. You can still vote. To be considered for induction, toys must have achieved icon status and longevity across generations. They also must be innovative and foster learning or creativity through play. Last year, Light Bright, Masters of the Universe, and The Top were inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame. So I know we talk about innovation a lot, and I realize there are some STEM components here as well that would endear some of these more to industry. But I just want to talk about, from the perspective of just personal nostalgia, mm-hmm. like there are some super great options on this list. Yeah. Like, what are your top three? Like, it took me a while to think through this, but that's why we're late today. Is I just sitting,
brainstorm on this
just
one.
Sitting on my desk thinking about this. I think if I had to keep three, I'm Battleship, TMNT, and Choose Your Own Adventure, because baseball cards are not a toy. That's where I mean, maybe they qualify and whatever, but to me, that's not. So there was too. I was too serious about it.
Yeah, I'm surprised a couple of these aren't already in, like Connect Four and Nerf. Like I thought those two would already be in. For me, I mean, I would definitely be with you in the Choose Your Own Adventure game books. Like those were.
I love those.
Those were one of the only thing I would read when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So those would definitely go in for me. I think Nerf would. I mean, I had multiple Nerf footballs, indoor basketball, all of that. After that, boy, it would either be Connect Four or Battleship, I think. One of those two. I loved a lot of those.
Yeah, I loved Battleship, man. So Ben?
Oh, man. I know. They're all pretty great here. Connect Four, for sure.
For sure. Okay.
Yeah, all right. For sure. Nerf, I'm kind of confused about, too. Are we talking about the material?
All of it.
Is it the material called Nerf? Like, this football is made of Nerf?
Yeah, because now they have, like, those dart guns or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that feels different than like the balls that were, you know.
Yeah, the picture they show in here is like the original indoor ball.
Yeah.
Which, that was all right. But
I think Nerf and probably Bop It.
Oh, I love Bop It.
Yeah.
That was a tough one.
Like the first Christmas, we got the Bop It. We just played it like nonstop. It was awesome.
So horrible
at
that.
My dad is really bad at it. Can't do it.
Bop It. Twist like, it.
Yes, it was a source of rage because the girls were always very good at it and I was not.
That's why they like to play with you.
They enjoyed it so much.
Well, if anyone that is listening wants to send us their top three, I'd love to know. But also, you guys vote. Yeah, you should vote.
I love the Hall of Fame too because it has a lot of stuff on there that's not necessarily you wouldn't think of as a toy, like sand.
Sand
is in the Hall of Fame.
The box, I believe, is in there.
Oh, yeah. You're trying to prove a point there when you do that.
Right? Ball.
Ball.
Just ball. Yeah.
The ball.
I feel like stick was in the Hall of Fame, too.
Of course. Yeah.
I say if folks want to send in their vote, we'll even send them a wonderful Today in Manufacturing can koozie for their efforts.
You could play Bop It while drinking.
Don't play Bop It. Bring it back.
Traumatic.
Look, Dad can't do it.
How bad at Bop It are you?
Really bad. Really bad.
Got to work on those reflexes.
Yes.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for today. I guess we should do final thoughts. Ben, you got anything?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about dad jokes. We, you know, at IEN, we love them.
Just dad jokes all day long in the office.
We tell them in the office and sometimes we laugh. But I feel like lately it's been really difficult to find new dad jokes. So if you're out there and you have any new ones, please send them our way. We need like new dad jokes.
Good call. Yeah. I think you guys have reached the end of the internet.
Yeah. It used to be like a good 10 or 20 a day. And now it's like, we're lucky if we can find one.
What's funny is half of that crew that's into the dad jokes have no children.
Yeah, that's true.
They're into the dad jokes too soon. You've kind of ruined it for me, quite honestly.
Whoa.
Yeah.
We've ruined
dad jokes because some of them are so bad. I mean, they're even worse than the ones that I would try to annoy the kids with.
The dad jokes are kind of segmented to one side of the office, right?
True.
Yeah, there is definitely a dad jokes side of the office. Jeff and I sit on the other side.
Yes.
We
roll our eyes in judgment and disdain.
We don't tell any jokes. We just work.
We have no time for silliness.
We just make jokes about the people telling dad jokes all day.
My final thought is... David, we look forward to having you back next week. Being in the hot seat is weird and I don't like it. I need to move back over here. So
your hand gestures are much more controlled than his.
And my voice does
go
up and up and up. Yeah.
No, it does not. Nobody elevates like David.
Yep. I don't know how to do that. So, but no, it's great having you on this week, Ben.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks for coming. We have some other, Jeff is out next week and then I'm out the week after. So it's going to be a little bit.
Get used to Ben.
Yeah. I hope you like Ben.
He's going to be here a while.
You're going to see him again.
This is the first I'm hearing of any of this. So that's.
Ben, can you fill in next week?
What are you doing next Thursday, Ben?
Yeah, I can do it.
Because guess what I'm going to be doing? I'll be fishing in the Great White North and I cannot wait to do it. Is the fishing pole in the Toy Hall of Fame?
Oh, probably, right?
Or should it be?
Oh, I closed it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I wonder if that was it. Yeah, that's where I will be next week. I am very much looking forward to it. Getting out there, this will be the first time I've been fishing this year where I'm not just the person baiting the hook or taking the fish off the hook for my family. So be nice. Because everything, well, no, when you go with my daughters and my wife, like I just sitting back on the pier and they just keep catching and I just have to take them off the hook. I'm just kind of an automated.
You're like the assistant?
Yeah. I'm just there to make. Make sure they have fun fishing.
Oh, well, which that's is nice. Fine too. Yeah, and then tell some dad jokes.
No, then they might hit me with the fish or something. So, no, none of that. But yeah, so thanks for filling in next week, man. I'm out.
We will miss you, Jeff. All right. For everyone who joined us today, thank you so much. We love having people in the live chat. So if you haven't, please sign up on our YouTube channel to get the notifications so we can just be all over the place on the time. We just can't commit to a time. Please make sure to like, subscribe to, and share the podcast and to email the podcast. Once again, you can reach us at Jeff, Anna, or Ben at IN.com. Tell us your top three toys. We really want to know those top three toys. Subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters if you can at IN.com.